16. It happens fast. They have been after Callahan for a long time now, but they waste little time gloating. The doors slam shut behind them, much too loudly and hard enough to shiver in their frames. Executive assistants who drag down $18,000 a year to start with close doors a certain way, with respect for money and power, and this isn't it. This is the way angry drunks and addicts on the Jones close doors. Also crazy people, of course. Crazy people are ace door slammers. Callahan's alarm systems are fully engaged now, not pinging but howling. And when he looks around the executive conference room, dominated at the far end by a large window giving a terrific view of Lake Michigan, he sees there's a good reason for this and has time to think, "Dear Christ, Mary, Mother of God, how could I have been so foolish?" He can see 13 people in the room. 3 are low men, and this is his first good look at their heavy, unhealthy-looking faces, red-glinting eyes, and full, womanish lips. All 3 are smoking. 9 are type 3 vampires. The 13th person in the conference room is wearing a loud shirt and clashing tie, low men attire for certain, but his face has a lean and foxy look, full of intelligence and dark humor. On his brow is a red circle of blood that seems neither to ooze nor to clot. There is a bitter crackling sound. Callahan wheels and sees Al and Ward drop to the floor. Standing to either side of the door through which they entered are numbers 14 and 15, a low man and a low woman, both of them holding electrical stunners. "Your friends will be all right, Father Callahan." He whirls around again. It's the man with the blood spot on his forehead. He looks about 60, but it's hard to tell. He's wearing a garish yellow shirt and a red tie. When his thin lips part in a smile, they reveal teeth that come to points. "It's Sayre," Callahan thinks. "Sayre, or whoever signed that letter. Whoever thought this little sting up. You, however, won't," he continues. The low men look at him with a kind of dull avidity. Here he is, finally, their lost pooch with the burned paw and the scarred forehead. The vampires are more interested. They almost thrum within their blue auras. And all at once, Callahan can hear the chimes. They're faint, somehow damped down, but they're there, calling him. Sayre, if that's his name, turns to the vampires. "He's the one," he says in a matter-of-fact tone. "He's killed hundreds of you in a dozen versions of America. My friends," he gestures to the low men, "were unable to track him down, but of course they seek other, less suspecting prey in the ordinary course of things. In any case, he's here now. Go on. Have at him, but don't kill him." He turns to Callahan. The hole in his forehead fills and gleams, but never drips. "It's an eye," Callahan thinks, "a bloody eye. What is looking out of it? What is watching, and from where?" Sayre says, "These particular friends of the king all carry the AIDS virus. You surely know what I mean, don't you? We'll let that kill you. It will take you out of the game forever, in this world and all the others. This is no game for a fellow like you anyway. A false priest like you." Callahan doesn't hesitate. If he hesitates, he will be lost. It's not AIDS he's afraid of, but of letting them put their filthy lips on him in the first place. To kiss him as the one was kissing Lupe Delgado in the alley. They don't get to win. After all the way he's come, after all the jobs, all the jail cells, after finally getting sober in Kansas, they don't get to win. He doesn't try to reason with them. There is no palaver. He just sprints down the right side of the conference room's extravagant mahogany table. The man in the yellow shirt, suddenly alarmed, shouts, "Get him! Get him! Hands slap at his jacket, specially bought at Grand River Menswear for this auspicious occasion, but slip off. He has time to think. The window won't break. It's made of some tough glass, anti-suicide glass, and it won't break. And he has just time enough to call on God for the first time since Barlow forced him to take of his poisoned blood. "Help me! Please help me!" Father Callahan cries and runs shoulder first into the window. One more hand slaps at his head, tries to tangle itself in his hair, and then it is gone. The window shatters all around him, and suddenly he is standing in cold air, surrounded by flurries of snow. He looks down between black shoes, which were also specially purchased for this auspicious occasion, and he sees Michigan Avenue, with cars like toys and people like ants. He has a sense of them, Sayre and the low men and the vampires who were supposed to infect him and take him out of the game forever, clustered at the broken window, staring with disbelief. He thinks, "This does take me out of it forever, doesn't it?" And he thinks, with the wonder of a child, "This is the last thought I'll ever have. This is goodbye." Then he is falling. 17. Callahan stopped and looked at Jake almost shyly.
"Do you remember it?" he asked. "The actual..."
He cleared his throat.
"The dying?"
Jake nodded gravely.
"You don't?" "I remember looking at Michigan Avenue from between my new shoes. I remember the sensation of standing there, seeming to anyway, in the middle of a snow flurry. I remember Sayre behind me, yelling in some other language, cursing, words that guttural just about had to be curses. And I remember thinking, 'He's frightened.' That was actually my last thought, that Sayre was frightened. Then there was an interval of darkness. I floated. I could hear the chimes, but they were distant. Then they came closer, as if they were mounted on some engine that was rushing toward me at terrible speed. There was light. I saw light in the darkness. I thought I was having the Kubler-Ross death experience, and I went toward it. I didn't care where I came out as long as it wasn't on Michigan Avenue, all smashed and bleeding, with a crowd standing around me. But I didn't see how that could happen. You don't fall 33 stories then regain consciousness. And I wanted to get away from the chimes. They kept getting louder. My eyes started to water. My ears hurt. I was glad I still had eyes and ears, but the chimes made any gratitude I might have felt pretty academic. I thought, I have to get into the light, and I lunged for it. I...
18. He opens his eyes, but even before he does, he is aware of a smell. It's the smell of hay, but very faint, almost exhausted. A ghost of its former self, you might say. And he? Is he a ghost? He sits up and looks around. If this is the afterlife, then all the holy books of the world, including the one from which he himself used to preach, are wrong. Because he's not in heaven or hell. He's in a stable. There are white wisps of ancient straw on the floor. There are cracks in the board walls through which brilliant light streams. It's the light he followed out of the darkness, he thinks. And he thinks, it's desert light. Is there any concrete reason to think so? Perhaps. The air is dry when he pulls it into his nostrils. It's like drawing the air of a different planet. Maybe it is, he thinks. Maybe this is the planet afterlife. The chimes are still there, both sweet and horrible, but now fading, fading, and gone. He hears the faint snuffle of hot wind. Some of it finds its way through the gaps between the boards, and a few bits of straw lift off from the floor, do a tired little dance, then settle back. Now there's another noise, an arrhythmic thudding noise. Some machine, and not in the best of shape from the sound, he stands up. It's hot in here, and sweat breaks immediately on his face and hands. He looks down at himself and sees his fine, new Grand River menswear clothes are gone.
He's now wearing jeans and a blue chambray shirt, faded thin from many washings. On his feet is a pair of battered boots with run-down heels. They look like they've walked many a thirsty mile. He bends and feels his legs for breaks. There appear to be none. Then his arms. None. He tries snapping his fingers. They do the job easily, making little dry sounds like breaking twigs. He thinks, was my whole life a dream? Is this the reality? If so, who am I and what am I doing here? And from the deeper shadows behind him comes that weary cycling sound, thud, 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 thud. He turns in that direction and gasps at what he sees. Standing behind him, in the middle of the abandoned stable, is a door. It's set into no wall, only stands free. It has hinges, but as far as he can see, they connect the door to nothing but air. Hieroglyphs are etched upon it halfway up. He cannot read them. He steps closer, as if that would aid understanding, and in a way it does, because he sees that the doorknob is made of crystal, and etched upon it is a rose. He has read his Thomas Wolfe. A stone, a rose, an unfound door. A stone, a rose, a door. There's no stone, but perhaps that's the meaning of the hieroglyph. No, he thinks. No, the word is unfound. Maybe I'm the stone. He reaches out and touches the crystal knob, as though it were a signal. A sigil, he thinks. The thudding machinery ceases. Very faint, very distant, far and wee, he hears the chimes. He tries the knob. It moves in neither direction. There's not even the slightest give. It might as well be set in concrete. When he takes his hand away, the sound of the chimes ceases. He walks around the door, and the door is gone. Walks the rest of the way around, and it's back. He makes three slow circles, noting the exact point at which the thickness of the door disappears on one side and reappears on the other. He reverses his course, now going widdershins. Same deal. What the hell? He looks at the door for several moments, pondering, then walks deeper into the stable, curious about the machine he heard. There's no pain when he walks. If he just took a long fall, his body hasn't yet got the news, but Christ, is it ever hot in here? There are horse stalls, long abandoned. There's a pile of ancient hay, and beside it, a neatly folded blanket and what looks like a breadboard. On the board is a single scrap of dried meat. He picks it up, sniffs it. Smells salt. Jerky, he thinks, and pops it into his mouth. He's not very worried about being poisoned. How can you poison a man who's already dead? Chewing, he continues his explorations. At the rear of the stable is a small room, like an afterthought. There are a few chinks in the walls of this room, too, enough for him to see a machine squatting on a concrete pad. Everything in the stable whispers of long years and abandonment, but this gadget, which looks sort of like a milking machine, appears brand new. No rust, no dust. He goes closer. There's a chrome pipe jutting from one side. Beneath it is a drain. The steel collar around it looks damp. On top of the machine is a small metal plate. Next to the plate is a red button. Stamped on the plate is this: La Merck Industries, 834789-AA-45-776019. Do not remove slug. Ask for assistance. The red button is stamped with the word ON. Callahan pushes it. The weary thudding sound resumes, and after a moment, water gushes from the chrome pipe. He puts his hands under it. The water is numbingly cold, shocking his overheated skin. He drinks. The water is neither sweet nor sour, and he thinks such things as taste must be forgotten at great depths. This... Hello, Fauna.
Callahan screams in surprise. His hands fly up, and for a moment, jewels of water sparkle in a dusty sunray falling between two shrunken boards. He wheels around on the eroded heels of his boots. Standing just outside the door of the pump room is a man in a hooded robe. Sayre, he thinks. It's Sayre. He's followed me. He came through that damn door. Calm down, says the man in the robe. Cool your jets, as the gunslinger's new friend might say. Confidingly, his name is Jake, but the housekeeper calls him Bama. And then, in the bright tone of one just struck by a fine idea, he says, I would show him to you, both of them. Perhaps it's not too late. Come. He holds out a hand. The fingers emerging from the robe's sleeve are long and white, somehow unpleasant, like wax. When Callahan makes no move to come forward, the man in the robe speaks reasonably, Come. You can't stay here, you know. This is only a way station, and nobody stays here for long. Come. Who are you? The man in the robe makes an impatient, tisking sound. No time for all that, fodder. Name, what's in a name? As someone or other said, Shakespeare, Virginia Woolf, who can remember? Come, and I'll show you a wonder, and I won't touch you. I'll walk ahead of you. See? He turns. His robe swirls like the skirt of an evening dress. He walks back into the stable, and after a moment Callahan follows. The pump room is no good to him, after all. The pump room is a dead end. Outside the stable he might be able to run. Run where? Well, that's to see, isn't it? The man in the robe raps on the freestanding door as he passes it. Knock on wood, Donnie be good, he says merrily, and as he steps into the brilliant rectangle of light falling through the stable door, Callahan sees he's carrying something in his left hand. It's a box, perhaps a foot long and wide and deep. It looks like it might be made of the same wood as the door. Or perhaps it's a heavier version of that wood. Certainly it's darker and even closer grained. Watching the robed man carefully, meaning to stop if he stops, Callahan follows into the sun. The heat is even stronger once he's in the light, the sort of heat he's felt in Death Valley. And yes, as they step out of the stable, he sees that they are in a desert. Off to one side is a ramshackle building that rises from a foundation of crumbling sandstone blocks. It might once have been an inn, he supposes, or an abandoned set from a Western movie. On the other side is a corral where most of the posts and rails have fallen. Beyond it, he sees miles of rocky, stony sand. Nothing else but... Yes. Yes, there is something. Two somethings. Two tiny, moving dots at the far horizon. You see them. How excellent your eyes must be, Fada. The man in the robe, its black, his face within the hood nothing but a pallid suggestion, stands about 20 paces from him. He titters. Callahan cares for the sound no more than for the waxy look of his fingers. It's like the sound of mice scampering over bones. That makes no actual sense. But who are they? Callahan asks in a dry voice. Who are you? Where is this place? The man in black sighs theatrically. So much backstory, so little time, he says. Call me Walter, if you like. As for this place, it's a way station, just as I told you. A little rest stop between the hoot of your world and the holler of the next. Oh, you thought you were quite the far wanderer, didn't you, following all those hidden highways of yours? But now, Fada, you're on a real journey. Stop calling me that, Callahan shouts. His throat is already dry. The sunny heat seems to be accumulating on top of his head like actual weight. Fada, 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 the man in black says. He sounds petulant, but Callahan knows he's laughing inside. He has an idea this man, if he is a man, spends a great deal of time laughing on the inside.
Oh, well, no need to be pissy about it, I suppose. I'll call you Don. Do you like that better? The black specks in the distance are wavering now. The rising thermals cause them to levitate, disappear, then reappear again. Soon they'll be gone for good. Who are they? He asked the man in black. Folks you'll almost certainly never meet, the man in black says dreamily. The hood shifts. For a moment, Callahan can see the waxy blade of a nose and the curve of an eye, a small cup filled with dark fluid. They'll die under the mountains. If they don't die under the mountains, there are things in the Western Sea that will eat them alive. Dada chock, he laughs again. But all at once, you don't sound completely sure of yourself, my friend, Callahan thinks. If all else fails, Walter says, this will kill them. He raises the box. Again, faintly, Callahan hears the unpleasant ripple of the chimes. And who will bring it to them? Ka, of course. Yet even Ka needs a friend. A Ka Mai, that would be you. I don't understand. No. The man in black agrees, sadly, and I don't have time to explain. Like the white rabbit in Alice, I'm late for a very important date. They're following me, you see, but I needed to double back and talk to you. Busy, busy, busy. Now I must get ahead of them again. How else will I draw them on? You and I, Don, must be done with our palaver, regrettably short though it has been. Back into the stable with you, amigo, quick as a bunny. What if I don't want to? Only there's really no what-if about it. He's never wanted to go any place less. Suppose he asks this fellow to let him go and try to catch up with those wavering specks. What if he tells the man in black, that's where I'm supposed to be, where what you call Ka wants me to be? He guesses he knows. Might as well spit in the ocean. As if to confirm this, Walter says, what you want hardly matters. You'll go where the king decrees, and there you will wait. If yon two die on their course, as they almost certainly must, you will live a life of rural serenity in the place to which I send you. And there you too will die, full of years and possibly with a false but undoubtedly pleasing sense of redemption. You'll live on your level of the tower long after I'm bone dust on mine. This I promise you, Fada, for I have seen it in the glass say true. And if they keep coming? If they reach you in the place to which you are going? Why, in that unlikely case, you'll aid them in every way you can and kill them by doing so. It's a mind-blower, isn't it? Wouldn't you say it's a mind-blower? He begins to walk toward Callahan. Callahan backs toward the stable where the unfound door awaits. He doesn't want to go there, but there's nowhere else. Get away from me, he says. Nope, says Walter, the man in black. I can't go for that. No can do. He holds the box out toward Callahan. At the same time, he reaches over the top of it and grasps the lid. Don't, Callahan says sharply, because the man in the black robe mustn't open the box. There's something terrible inside the box, something that would terrify even Barlow, the wily vampire who forced Callahan to drink his blood and then sent him on his way into the prisms of America like a fractious child whose company has become tiresome. Keep moving, and perhaps I won't have to, Walter teases. Callahan backs into the stable's scant shadow. Soon he'll be inside again, no help for it, and he can feel that strange, only there on one side, door, waiting like a weight. You're cruel, he bursts out. Walter's eyes widen, and for a moment he looks deeply hurt. This may be absurd, but Callahan is looking into the man's deep eyes and feels sure the emotion is nonetheless genuine. And the surety robs him of any last hope that all this might be a dream or a final, brilliant interval before true death. In dreams, his at least, the bad guys, the scary guys, never have complex emotions.
I am what Ka and the king and the tower have made me. We all are. We're caught. Callahan remembers the dream west through which he traveled, the forgotten silos, the neglected sunsets and long shadows, his own bitter joy as he dragged his trap behind him, singing until the jingle of the very chains that held him became sweet music.
I know, he says.
Yes, I see you do. Keep moving. Callahan's back in the stable now. Once again he can smell the faint, almost exhausted aroma of old hay. Detroit seems impossible, a hallucination. So do all his memories of America.
Don't open that thing, Callahan says, and I will.
What an excellent fodder you are, fodder.
You promise not to call me that.
Promises are made to be broken, fodder.
I don't think you'll be able to kill him, Callahan said.
Walter grimaces. That's Ka's business, not mine.
Maybe not Ka either. Suppose he's above Ka.
Walter recoils as if struck.
I've blasphemed, Callahan thinks. And with this guy, I've an idea that's no mean feat.
No one's above Ka, false priest, the man in black spits at him. And the room at the top of the tower is empty. I know it is. Although Callahan is not entirely sure what the man is talking about, his response is quick and sure.
You're wrong. There is a god. He waits and sees all from his high place. He...
Then a great many things happen at exactly the same time. The water pump in the alcove goes on, starting its weary thudding cycle, and Callahan's ass bumps into the heavy, smooth wood of the door, and the man in black thrusts the box forward, opening it as he does so. And his hood falls back, revealing the pallid, snarling face of a human weasel. It's not Sare, but upon Walter's forehead, like a Hindu caste mark, is the same welling red circle, an open wound that never clots or flows. And Callahan sees what's inside the box. He sees Black 13, crouched on its red velvet like the slick eye of a monster that grew outside God's shadow. And Callahan begins to shriek at the sight of it, for he senses its endless power. It may fling him anywhere or to the farthest blind alley of nowhere. And the door clicks open. And even in his panic, or perhaps below his panic, Callahan is able to think, opening the box has opened the door. And he is stumbling backward into some other place. He can hear shrieking voices. One of them is Lupe's, asking Callahan why Callahan let him die. Another belongs to Rowena Magruder, and she's telling him this is his other life, this is it, and how does he like it? And his hands come up to cover his ears, even as one ancient boot trips over the other, and he begins to fall backward, thinking it's hell. The man in black has pushed him into actual hell. And when his hands come up, the weasel-faced man thrusts the open box with its terrible glass ball into them. And the ball moves. It rolls like an actual eye in an invisible socket. And Callahan thinks, it's alive. It's the stolen eye of some awful monster from beyond the world. And, oh God, oh dear God, it is seeing me. But he takes the box. It's the last thing in life he wants to do, but he is powerless to stop himself.
Close it. You have to close it, he thinks. But he is falling. He has tripped himself,
or the robed man's car has tripped him, and he's falling, twisting around as he goes down. From somewhere below him, all the voices of his past are calling to him, reproaching him. His mother wants to know why he allowed that filthy Barlow to break the cross she brought him all the way from Ireland. And incredibly, the man in black cries, "Bon voyage, Fada!" merrily after him. Callahan strikes a stone floor. It's littered with the bones of small animals. The lid of the box closes and he feels a moment of sublime relief. But then it opens again, very slowly, disclosing the eye.
No, Callahan whispers. Please, no.
But he's not able to close the box. All his strength seems to have deserted him, and it will not close itself. Deep down in the black eye, a red speck forms, glows, grows. Callahan's horror swells, filling his throat, threatening to stop his heart with its chill.
It's the king, He thinks it's the eye of the Crimson King as he looks down from his place in the Dark Tower. And he is seeing me. No, Callahan shrieks as he lies on the floor of a cave in the northern Arroyo country of Calabrin Sturgis, a place he will eventually come to love. No, no, don't look at me. Oh, for the love of God, don't look at me. But the eye does look, and Callahan cannot bear its insane regard. That is when he passes out. It will be 3 days before he opens his own eyes again, and when he does, he'll be with the Manny. 19. Callahan looked at them wearily. Midnight had come and gone, we all say thank you, and now it was 22 days until the wolves would come for their bounty of children. He drank off the final 2 inches of cider in his glass, grimaced as if it had been corn whiskey, then set the empty tumbler down. And all the rest, as they say, you know. It was Henchik and Jemin who found me. Henchik closed the box, and when he did, the door closed. And now what was the Cave of the Voices is Doorway Cave.
And you, Pear? Susanna asked. What did they do with you?
Took me to Henchik's cabin, his kra. That's where I was when I opened my eyes. During my unconsciousness, his wives and daughters fed me water and chicken broth, squeezing drops from a rag one by one.
Just out of curiosity, how many wives does he have? Eddie asked.
3. But he may have relations with only one at a time, Callahan said absently. It depends on the stars or something. They nursed me well. I began to walk around the town. In those days they called me the walking old fella. I couldn't quite get the sense of where I was, but in a way my previous wanderings had prepared me for what had happened, had toughened me mentally. I had days, God knows, when I thought all of this was happening in the second or two it would take me to fall from the window I'd broken through down to Michigan Avenue, that the mind prepares itself for death by offering some wonderful final hallucination, the actual semblance of an entire life. And I had days when I decided that I had finally become what we all dreaded most at both home and lighthouse, a wet brain. I thought maybe I'd been socked away in a moldy institution somewhere and was imagining the whole thing. But mostly, I just accepted it, and was glad to have finished up in a good place, real or imagined. When I got my strength back, I reverted to making a living the way I had during my years on the road. There was no manpower or brawny man office in Calabrin Sturgis, but those were good years, and there was plenty of work for a man who wanted to work. They were big rice years, as they do say, although stock line and the rest of the crops also did fine. Eventually, I began to preach again. There was no conscious decision to do so. It wasn't anything I prayed over, God knows, and when I did, I discovered these people knew all about the man Jesus. He laughed. Along with the Over and Oriza and Buffalo Star. Do you know Buffalo Star, Roland?
Oh, yes, the gunslinger said, remembering a preacher of the Buff whom he had once been forced to kill.
But they listened, Callahan said. A lot did, anyway, and when they offered to build me a church, I said thank you. And that's the old fellow's story. As you see, you were in it, 2 of you, anyway. Jake, was that after you died?
Jake lowered his head. Oi, sensing his distress, whined uneasily. But when Jake answered, his voice was steady enough.
After the first death, before the second.
Callahan looked visibly startled, and he crossed himself.
You mean it can happen more than once? Mary save us.
Rosalita had left them. Now she came back, holding a senior high, those which had been placed on the table that almost burned down, and the porch was cast in a dim and failing glow that was both eerie and a little sinister.
Beds is ready, she said. Tonight the boy sleeps with Pear. Eddie and Susanna, as you were night before last.
And Roland?
Asked Callahan, his bushy brows raising. I have a cozy for him, she said stolidly. I showed it to him earlier.
Did you? Callahan said. Did you now? Well, then, that's settled.
He stood.
I can't remember the last time I was so tired.
We'll stay another few minutes if it does you, Roland said. Just we four.
As you will, Callahan said.
Susanna took his hand and impulsively kissed it. Thank you for your story, Pear.
It's good to have finally told it, Si.
Roland asked. The box stayed in the cave until the church was built. Your church?
I can't say how long, maybe 8 years, maybe less. 'Tis hard to tell with certainty, but there came a time when it began to call to me. As much as I hated and feared that part of me wanted to see it again.
Roland nodded.
All the pieces of the wizard's rainbow are full of glamour, but Black 13 was ever told to be the worst. Now I think I understand why that is. It's this Crimson King's actual watching eye.
Whatever it is, I felt it calling me back to the cave, and further, whispering that I should resume my wanderings and make them endless. I knew I could open the door by opening the box. The door would take me anywhere I wanted to go, and any when. All I had to do was concentrate,
Callahan considered, then sat down again. He leaned forward, looking at them in turn over the gnarled carving of his clasped hands.
Hear me, I beg. We had a president. Kennedy was his name. He was assassinated some 13 years before my time in Salem's lot. Assassinated in the West.
Yes, Susanna said. Jack Kennedy, God love him. She turned to Roland. He was a gunslinger.
Roland's eyebrows rose. Do you say so?
Aye, and I say true.
In any case, Callahan said, there's always been a question as to whether the man who killed him acted alone or whether he was part of a larger conspiracy. And sometimes I'd wake in the middle of the night and think, why don't you go and see? Why don't you stand in front of that door with the box in your arms and think, Dallas, November 22nd, 1963. Because if you do that, the door will open and you can go there, just like the man in Mr. Wells's story of the time machine. And perhaps you could change what happened that day, if there was ever a watershed moment in American life. That was it. Change that. Change everything that came after. Vietnam, the race riots, everything.
Jesus, Eddie said respectfully. If nothing else, you had to respect the ambition of such an idea. It was right up there with the peg-legged sea captain chasing the white whale. But, Pear, what if you did it and changed things for the worse? Jack Kennedy was not a bad man, Susanna said coldly. Jack Kennedy was a good man. A great man.
Maybe so, but you know what? I think it takes a great man to make a great mistake. And besides, someone who came after him might have been a really bad guy, some big coffin hunter who never got a chance because of Lee Harvey Oswald or whoever it was. But the ball doesn't allow such thoughts, Callahan said. I believe it lures people on to acts of terrible evil by whispering to them that they will do good, that they'll make things not just a little better, but all better.
Yes, Roland said. His voice was as dry as the snap of a twig in a fire.
Do you think such traveling might actually be possible?
Callahan asked him.
Or was it only the thing's persuasive lie, its glamour?
I believe it's so, Roland said. And I believe that when we leave the Kala, it'll be by that door.
Would that I could come with you,
Callahan said. He spoke with surprising vehemence.
Mayhap you will, Roland said. In any case, you finally put the box and the ball within, inside your church, to quiet it.
Yes, and mostly it's worked. Mostly it sleeps.
Yet you said it sent your toe dash twice.
Callahan nodded. The vehemence had flared like a pine knot in a fireplace and disappeared just as quickly. Now he only looked tired and very old indeed.
The first time was to Mexico. Do you remember way back to the beginning of my story, the writer and the boy who believed?
They nodded.
One night the ball reached out to me when I slipped and took me toe-dash to Los Zapatos, Mexico. It was a funeral, the writer's funeral.
Ben Mears, Eddie said, the air dance guy.
Yes.
Did folks see you? Jake asked. Because they didn't see us.
Callahan shook his head.
No, but they sensed me. When I walked toward them, they moved away. It was as if I'd turned into a cold draft. In any case, the boy was there, Mark Petrie. Only he wasn't a boy any longer. He was in his young manhood. From that and from the way he spoke of Ben, there was a time when I would have called 59 old, is how he began his eulogy. I'd guess that this might have been the mid-1990s. In any case, I didn't stay long, but long enough to decide that my young friend from all that long time ago had turned out fine. Maybe I did something right in Salem's lot after all.
He paused a moment and then said,
in his eulogy, Mark referred to Ben as his father. That touched me very, very deeply.
And the second time the ball sent you, Todash? Roland asked. The time it sent you to the castle of the king?
They were birds. Great fat black birds, and beyond that I'll not speak. Not in the middle of the night.
Callahan spoke in a dry voice that brooked no argument. He stood up again.
Another time, perhaps.
Roland bowed acceptance of this.
Say thank you.
Will you not turn in, folks?
Soon, Roland said.
They thanked him for his story. Even Oi added a single sleepy bark and bade him good night. They watched him go, and for several seconds after, they said nothing.
20.
It was Jake who broke the silence.
That guy Walter was behind us, Roland. When we left the way station, he was behind us. Pear Callahan, too.
Yes, Roland said. As far back as that, Callahan was in our story. It makes my stomach flutter as though I'd lost gravity.
Eddie dabbed at the corner of his eye.
Whenever you show emotion like that, Roland, he said, I get all warm and squashy inside.
Then when Roland only looked at him,
ah, come on, quit laughing. You know I love it when you get the joke, but you're embarrassing me.
Cry pardon, Roland said with a faint smile. Such humor as I have turns in early.
Mine stays up all night, Eddie said brightly. Keeps me awake. Tells me jokes. Knock, knock, who's there? Icy who? Icy your underwear. Yuck, yuck, yuck.
Is it out of your system? Roland asked when he had finished.
For the time being, yeah, but don't worry, Roland. It always comes back. Can I ask you something?
Is it foolish?
I don't think so. I hope not.
Then ask.
Those two men who saved Callahan's bacon in the laundromat on the east side, were they who I think they were?
Who do you think they were?
Eddie looked at Jake.
What about you, oh son of Elmer? Got any ideas?
Sure, Jake said. It was Calvin Tower and the other guy from the bookshop, his friend. The one who told me the Samson riddle and the river riddle.
He snapped his fingers once, then twice, then grinned.
Aaron Deepnow.
What about the ring Callahan mentioned? Eddie asked him. The one with Ex Libris on it? I didn't see either of them wearing a ring like that.
Were you looking? Jake asked him.
No, not really, but... And remember that we saw him in 1977, Jake said. Those guys saved Pear's life in 1981. Maybe someone gave Mr. Tower the ring during the 4 years between. As a present. Or maybe he bought it himself.
You're just guessing, Eddie said.
Yeah, Jake agreed. But Tower owns a bookshop, so him having a ring with Ex Libris on it fits. Can you tell me it doesn't feel right?
No, I'd have to put it in the 90th percentile at least. But how could they know that Callahan...
Eddie trailed off, considered, then shook his head decisively.
Nah, I'm not even going to get into it tonight. Next thing we'll be discussing the Kennedy assassination, and I'm tired.
We're all tired, Roland said, and we have much to do in the days ahead, yet the pair's story has left me in a strangely disturbed frame of mind. I can't tell if it answers more questions than it raises, or if it's the other way around. None of them responded to this.
We are quartet, and now we sit together en tête, Roland said. In council. Late as it is there anything else we need to discuss before we part from one another? If so, you must say.
When there was no response, Roland pushed back his chair.
All right. Then I wish you all...
Wait. It was Susanna. It had been so long since she'd spoken that they had nearly forgotten her. And she spoke in a small voice, not much like her usual one. Certainly, it didn't seem to belong to the woman who had told Eben Took that if he called her Brownie again, she'd pull the tongue out of his head and wipe his ass with it.
There might be something.
That same small voice.
Something else.
And smaller still.
I...
She looked at them, each in turn, and when she came to the gunslinger, he saw sorrow in those eyes, and reproach, and weariness. He saw no anger. If she'd been angry, he thought later, I might not have felt quite so ashamed.
I think I might have a little problem, she said. I don't see how it can be, how it can possibly be, but boys, I think I might be a little bit in the family way.
Having said that, Susanna Dean, Odetta Holmes, Detta Walker, Mia, daughter of Nun, put her hands over her face and began to cry. Part 3. The Wolves. Chapter 1. Secrets. 1. Behind the cottage of Rosalita Munoz was a tall privy painted sky blue. Jutting from the wall to the left as the gunslinger entered, late on the morning after Pere Callahan had finished his story, was a plain iron band with a small disc of steel set 8 inches or so beneath. Within this skeletal vase was a double sprig of Saucy Susan. Its lemony, faintly astringent smell was the privy's only aroma. On the wall above the seat of ease, in a frame and beneath glass, was a picture of the man Jesus with his praying hands held just below his chin, his reddish locks spilling over his shoulders, and his eyes turned up to his father. Roland had heard there were tribes of slow mutants who referred to the father of Jesus as Big Sky Daddy. The image of the man Jesus was in profile, and Roland was glad. Had he been facing him full on, the gunslinger wasn't sure he could have done his morning business without closing his eyes, full though his bladder was. Strange place to put a picture of God's son, he thought, and then realized it wasn't strange at all. In the ordinary course of things, only Rosalita used this privy, and the man Jesus would have nothing to look at but her prim back. Roland Deschain burst out laughing, and when he did, his water began to flow. 2. Rosalita had been gone when he awoke, and not recently. Her side of the bed had been cold. Now, standing outside her tall blue oblong of a privy and buttoning his flies, Roland looked up at the sun and judged the time as not long before noon. Judging such things without a clock, glass, or pendulum had become tricky in these latter days, but it was still possible if you were careful in your calculations and willing to allow for some error in your result. Court, he thought, would be aghast if he saw one of his pupils, one of his graduated pupils, a gunslinger, beginning such a business as this by sleeping almost until midday. And this was the beginning. All the rest had been ritual and preparation, necessary but not terribly helpful. A kind of dancing the rice song. Now that part was over.
and as for sleeping late, no one ever deserved a late lying in more, he said, and walked down the slope. Here a fence marked the rear of Callahan's patch, or perhaps the pair thought of it as God's patch. Beyond it was a small stream, babbling as excitedly as a little girl telling secrets to her best friend. The banks were thick with saucy Susan, so there was another mystery, a minor one, solved. Roland breathed deeply of the scent. He found himself thinking of Ka, which he rarely did. Eddie, who believed Roland thought of little else, would have been astounded. Its only true rule was stand aside and let me work. Why in God's name was it so hard to learn such a simple thing? Why always this stupid need to meddle? Every one of them had done it. Every one of them had known Susanna Dean was pregnant. Roland himself had known almost since the time of her kindling, when Jake had come through from the house in Dutch Hill. Susanna herself had known, in spite of the bloody rags she had buried at the side of the trail. So why had it taken them so long to have the palaver they'd had last night? Why had they made such a business of it? And how much might have suffered because of it? Nothing, Roland hoped. But it was hard to tell, wasn't it? Perhaps it was best to let it go. This morning that seemed like good advice because he felt very well, physically at least. Hardly an ache or a...
I thought he meant to turn in not long after I left you, gunslinger. But Rosalita said you never came in until almost the dawn.
Roland turned from the fence and his thoughts. Callahan was today dressed in dark pants, dark shoes, and a dark shirt with a notched collar. His cross lay upon his bosom, and his crazy white hair had been partially tamed, probably with some sort of grease. He bore the gunslinger's regard for a little while and then said,
"Yesterday I gave the Holy Communion to those of the small holds who take it, and heard their confessions. Today's my day to go out to the ranches and do the same. There's a goodish number of cowboys who hold to what they mostly call the cross way. Rosalita drives me in the buckboard, so when it comes to lunch and dinner, you must shift for yourselves."
"We can do that," Roland said. "But do you have a few minutes to talk to me?"
"Of course," Callahan said. "A man who can't stay a bit shouldn't approach in the first place. Good advice, I think, and not just for priests."
"Would you hear my confession?" Callahan raised his eyebrows.
"Do you hold to the man Jesus, then?"
Roland shook his head. "Not a bit. Will you hear it anyway, I beg? And keep it to yourself." Callahan shrugged.
"As to keeping what you say to myself, that's easy. It's what we do. Just don't mistake discretion for absolution."
He favored Roland with a wintry smile.
"We Catholics save that for ourselves. May it do you."
The thought of absolution had never crossed Roland's mind, and he found the idea that he might need it, or that this man could give it, almost comic. He rolled a cigarette, doing it slowly, thinking of how to begin and how much to say. Callahan waited, respectfully quiet. At last Roland said,
"There was a prophecy that I should draw three, and that we should become quartet. Never mind who made it. Never mind anything that came before. I won't worry that old knot, never again if I can help it. There were three doors. Behind the second was the woman who became Eddie's wife, although she did not at that time call herself Susanna."
3. So Roland told Callahan the part of their story which bore directly upon Susanna and the women who had been before her. He concentrated on how they'd saved Jake from the doorkeeper and drawn the boy into mid-world, telling how Susanna, or perhaps at that point she'd been Detta, had held the demon of the circle while they did their work. He had known the risks, Roland told Callahan, and he had become certain, even while they were still riding Blaine the Mono, that she had not survived the risk of pregnancy. He had told Eddie, and Eddie hadn't been all that surprised. Then Jake had told him, scolded him with it, actually. And he had taken the scolding, he said, because he felt it was deserved. What none of them had fully realized until last night on the porch was that Susanna herself had known, and perhaps for almost as long as Roland. She had simply fought harder.
So, Pear, what do you think?
You say her husband agreed to keep the secret,
Callahan replied.
And even Jake, who sees clearly.
Yes, Roland said. He does. He did. And when he asked me what we should do, I gave him bad advice. I told him we'd be best to let Ka work itself out, and all the time I was holding it in my hands like a caught bird.
Things always look clearer when we see them over our shoulder, don't they?
Yes.
Did you tell her last night that she's got a demon's spawn growing in her womb?
She knows it's not Eddie's.
So you didn't. And Mia? Did you tell her about Mia and the castle banqueting hall?
Yes, Roland said. I think hearing that depressed her, but didn't surprise her. There was the other, Detta, ever since the accident when she lost her legs.
It had been no accident, but Roland hadn't gone into the business of Jack Mort with Callahan, seeing no reason to do so.
Detta Walker hid herself well from Odetta Holmes. Eddie and Jake say she's a schizophrenic. Roland pronounced this exotic word with great care.
But you cured her, Callahan said. Brought her face to face with her two selves in one of those doorways, did you not?
Roland shrugged.
You can burn away warts by painting them with silver metal, Pear. But in a person prone to warts, they'll come back.
Callahan surprised him by throwing his head back to the sky and bellowing laughter. He laughed so long and hard he finally had to take his handkerchief from his back pocket and wipe his eyes with it.
Roland, you may be quick with a gun and as brave as Satan on Saturday night, but you're no psychiatrist. To compare schizophrenia to warts, oh my.
And yet Mia is real, Pear. I've seen her myself. Not in a dream, as Jake did, but with my own two eyes.
Exactly my point, Callahan said. She's not an aspect of the woman who was born Odetta Susanna Holmes. She is she.
Does it make a difference?
I think it does. But here is one thing I can tell you for sure. No matter how things lie in your fellowship, your quartet, this must be kept a dead secret from the people of Calabrine Sturgis. Today things are going your way, but if word got out that the female gunslinger with the brown skin might be carrying a demon child, the Falcon would go the other way and in a hurry, with Eben Took leading the parade. I know that in the end you'll decide your course of action based on your own assessment of what the color needs, but the four of you can't beat the wolves without help. No matter how good you are with such calibers as you carry, there's too much to manage.
Reply was unnecessary. Callahan was right.
What is it you fear most?
Callahan asked.
The breaking of the Tet, Roland said at once.
By that you mean Mia's taking control of the body they share and going off on her own to have the child?
If that happened at the wrong time, it would be bad, but all might still come right if Susanna came back. But what she carries is nothing but poison with a heartbeat.
Roland looked bleakly at the religious in his black clothes.
I have every reason to believe it would begin its work by slaughtering the mother.
The breaking of the Tet, Callahan mused. Not the death of your friend, but the breaking of the Tet. I wonder if your friends know what sort of man you are, Roland.
They know,
Roland said, and on that subject said no more.
What would you have of me?
First, an answer to a question. It's clear to me that Rosalita knows a good deal of rough doctoring. Would she know enough to turn the baby out before it's time? And the stomach for what she might find?
They would all have to be there, of course. He and Eddie, Jake too, as little as Roland liked the thought of it. Because the thing inside her had surely quickened by now, and even if its time hadn't come, it would be dangerous. And its time is almost certainly close, he thought. I don't know it for sure, but I feel it. The thought broke off as he became aware of Callahan's expression, horror, disgust, and mounting anger.
Rosalita would never do such a thing. Mark well what I say, she'd die first.
Roland was perplexed.
Why?
Because she's a Catholic.
I don't understand.
Callahan saw the gunslinger really did not. and the sharpest edge of his anger was blunted. Yet Roland sensed that a great deal remained, like the bolt behind the head of an arrow.
"It's abortion you're talking about."
"Yes."
"Roland! Roland!"
Callahan lowered his head, and when he raised it, the anger appeared to be gone. In its place was a stony obduracy the gunslinger had seen before. Roland could no more break it than he could lift a mountain with his bare hands.
"My church divides sins into two: venial sins, which are bearable in the sight of God, and mortal ones, which are not. Abortion is a mortal sin, it is murder."
"Pere, we are speaking of a demon, not a human being."
"So you say. That's God's business, not mine."
"And if it kills her, would you say the same then, and so wash your hands of her?" Roland had never heard the tale of Pontius Pilate, and Callahan knew it. Still, he winced at the image, but his reply was firm enough.
"You who spoke of the breaking of your tet before you spoke of the taking of her life, shame on you, shame."
"My quest, the quest of my quartet, is the Dark Tower, Pere. It's not saving this world we're about, or even this universe, but all universes, all of existence."
"I don't care," Callahan said. "I can't care. Now listen to me, Roland, son of Stephen, for I would have you hear me very well. Are you listening?"
Roland sighed. "Say thank you."
"Rosa won't give the woman an abortion. There are others in town who could, I have no doubt, even in a place where children are taken every 20-some years by monsters from the dark land. Such filthy arts are undoubtedly preserved. But if you go to one of them, you won't need to worry about the wolves. I'll raise every hand in Calabrian Sturgis against you long before they come."
Roland gazed at him unbelievingly. "Even though you know, as I'm sure you do, that we may be able to save 100 other children? Human children, whose first task on earth would not be to eat their mothers?" Callahan might not have heard. His face was very pale.
"I'll have more, do it please you, and even if it don't, I'll have your word sworn upon the face of your father that you'll never suggest an abortion to the woman herself."
A queer thought came to Roland. Now that this subject had arisen, had pounced upon them like Jilly out of her box, Susanna was no longer Susanna to this man. She had become the woman. And another thought, how many monsters had Pere Callahan slain himself with his own hand? As often happened in times of extreme stress, Roland's father spoke to him. "This situation is not quite beyond saving, but should you carry on much further, should you give voice to such thoughts, it will be."
"I want your promise, Roland."
"Or you'll raise the town."
"Aye."
"And suppose Susanna decides to abort herself. Women do it. And she's very far from stupid. She knows the stakes."
"Mia, the baby's true mother, will prevent it."
"Don't be so sure. Susanna Dean's sense of self-preservation is very strong, and I believe her dedication to our quest is even stronger." Callahan hesitated. He looked away, lips pressed together in a tight white line. Then he looked back.
"You will prevent it," he said, "as her Din."
Roland thought, "I have just been castled." "All right," he said. "I will tell her of our talk and make sure she understands the position you've put us in. And I'll tell her that she must not tell Eddie."
"Why not?"
"Because he'd kill you, Pere. He'd kill you for your interference." Roland was somewhat gratified by the widening of Callahan's eyes. He reminded himself again that he must raise no feelings in himself against this man who simply was what he was. Had he not already spoken to them of the trap he carried with him wherever he went? "Now listen to me, as I've listened to you, for you now have a responsibility to all of us. Especially to the woman." Callahan winced a little as if struck, but he nodded.
"Tell me what you'd have."
"For one thing, I'd have you watch her when you can, like a hawk. In particular, I'd have you watch for her working her fingers here." Roland rubbed above his left eyebrow. "Or here." Now he rubbed at his left temple. "Listen to her way of speaking. Be aware if it speeds up. Watch for her to start moving in little jerks." Roland snapped a hand up to his head, scratched it, snapped it back down. He tossed his head to the right, then looked back at Callahan. You see?
Yes. These are the signs that Mia is coming?
Roland nodded. I don't want her left alone anymore when she's Mia, not if I can help it.
I understand, Callahan said. But Roland, it's hard for me to believe that a newborn, no matter who or what the father might have been.
Hush, Roland said. Hush, do you? And when Callahan had duly hushed, what you think or believe is nothing to me. You've yourself to look out for, and I wish you well. But if Mia, or Mia's get, harms Rosalita, Pear, I'll hold you responsible for her injuries. You'll pay to my good hand. Do you understand that?
Yes, Roland.
Callahan looked both abashed and calm. It was an odd combination. All right. Now here's the other thing you can do for me. Comes the day of the wolves. I'm going to need 6 Falcon I can absolutely trust. I'd like to have 3 of each sex.
Do you care if some are parents with children at risk?
No, but not all. And none of the ladies who may be throwing the dish. Sari, Zelia, Margaret Eisenhart, Rosalita. They'll be somewhere else.
What do you want these 6 for?
Roland was silent. Callahan looked at him a moment longer, then sighed.
Reuben Cavera, he said. Reuben's never forgot his sister and how he loved her. Diane Cavera, his wife, or do you not want couples?
No, a couple would be all right. Roland twirled his fingers, gesturing for the pair to continue.
Cantab of the money, I should say. The children follow him like he was the Pied Piper.
I don't understand.
You don't need to. They follow him, that's the important part. Bucky Javier and his wife. And what would you say to your boy, Jake? Already the town children follow him with their eyes, and I suspect a number of the girls are in love with him.
No, I need him. Or can't bear to have him out of your sight, Callahan wondered, but did not say. He had pushed Roland as far as was prudent, at least for one day. Further, actually.
What of Andy, then? The children love him, too, and he'd protect them to the death.
Aye? From the wolves? Callahan looked troubled. Actually, it had been rock cats he'd been thinking of. Them, and the sort of wolves that came on 4 legs. As for the ones that came out of Thunderclap. No, Roland said. Not Andy.
Why not? For 'tisn't to fight the wolves you want these 6 for, is it?
Not Andy, Roland repeated. It was just a feeling, but his feelings were his version of the touch. There's time to think about it, Pear. And we'll think, too.
You're going out into the town?
Aye, today and every day for the next few. Callahan grinned.
Your friends and I would call it schmoozing. It's a Yiddish word.
Aye? What tribe are they?
An unlucky one, by all accounts. Here, schmoozing is called Kamala. It's their word for damn near everything.
Callahan was a little amused by how badly he wanted to regain the gunslinger's regard. A little disgusted with himself as well.
In any case, I wish you well with it.
Roland nodded. Callahan started up toward the rectory, where Rosalita already had harnessed the horses to the buckboard and now waited impatiently for Callahan to come so they could be about God's work. Halfway up the slope, Callahan turned back.
I do not apologize for my beliefs, he said, but if I have complicated your work here in the Kala, I'm sorry.
Your man Jesus seems to me a bit of a son of a bitch when it comes to women, Roland said. Was he ever married? The corners of Callahan's mouth quirked.
No, he said. But his girlfriend was a whore.
Well, Roland said, that's a start. 4. Roland went back to leaning on the fence. The day called out to him to begin, but he wanted to give Callahan a head start. There was no more reason for this than there had been for rejecting Andy out of hand, just a feeling. He was still there and rolling another smoke when Eddie came down the hill with his shirt flapping out behind him and his boots in one hand.
"Hi'll, Eddie," Roland said.
"Hi'll, boss. So you're talking with Callahan. Give us this day our Wilma and Fred."
Roland raised his eyebrows.
"Never mind," Eddie said.
Roland, in all the excitement, I never got a chance to tell your grandpa's story, and it's important.
Is Susanna up?
Yep, having a wash. Jake's eating what looks like a 12-egg omelet.
Roland nodded. I've fed the horses. We can saddle them while you tell me the old man's tale.
Don't think it'll take that long, Eddie said.
And it didn't. He came to the punchline, which the old man had whispered into his ear just as they reached the barn. Roland turned toward him, the horses forgotten. His eyes were blazing. The hands he clamped on Eddie's shoulders, even the diminished right, were powerful. Repeat it.
Eddie took no offense. He told me to lean close. I did. He said he'd never told anyone but his son, which I believe. Tien and Zelia know he was out there, or says he was, but they don't know what he saw when he pulled the mask off the thing. I don't think they even know Red Molly was the one who dropped it. And then he whispered.
Once again, Eddie told Roland what Tien's grandpere claimed to have seen. Roland's glare of triumph was so brilliant it was frightening. Gray horses, he said. All those horses, the exact same shade. Do you understand now, Eddie, do you?
Yep,
Eddie said. His teeth appeared in a grin. It was not particularly comforting, that grin.
As the chorus girl said to the businessman, we've been here before.